I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, the Biden administration announced a new EPA rule to limit greenhouse gas emissions by reducing the production and use of HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons. These are chemicals used in refrigerators and air conditioners and are more potent than CO2. This was legislation passed last year that had support from both Republicans and Democrats, as well as industry and environmental groups. And while the Biden administration has reversed a number of Trump policies, this is their first major environmental regulation. We asked Juliette Eilprin to join us. She's Deputy Climate and Environment Editor for The Washington Post. And Juliette, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
So let's do some basic chemistry, but we don't need to go too deep. We're on the radio here. We have no blackboard to use. But what exactly are hydrofluorocarbons?
Hydrofluorocarbons are chemical compounds. They're primarily used for refrigeration, although they're also used as propellants. And essentially, they're incredibly useful. People have them, in many different places. And when you go to the grocery store, they're chilling your produce and your ice cream. They're in air conditioners. They, for example, in the United States, they used to be in many car air conditioners, but actually that's been cut down in recent years. And so they're used around the world. And while they're certainly not as prevalent in the atmosphere and they don't last as long as things like carbon dioxide, which you get by burning fossil fuels, they're incredibly powerful greenhouse gases. And so there's a big incentive to phase them out.
Powerful how?
They are, depending on which hydrofluorocarbon or HFC you're talking about, they're hundreds to thousands of times more powerful than just carbon dioxide per unit.
So meaning that that while there might be less of them, they are still warming the planet?
Absolutely. And in fact, essentially, there was a global agreement in 2016 where the nations of the world, nearly 200 of them, agreed to cut their use over the next 15 years by 85%. And if the world follows through on that, that would avert a significant amount of warming by the end of the century. It would cut down on half a degree Celsius or 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, which is really significant when you hear these things bandied about, like we want to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or at most 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels.
So what does this new rule do here in the U.S.?
So what it does is the federal government has established a baseline to say this is how much we have in terms of the use and production of these chemicals right now. A bunch of them are produced here. Some of them are imported. And over the next 15 years, we're going to shave that amount over time by 85%. And it's going to essentially create a huge incentive for particularly manufacturers to stop producing this and instead make alternatives that can essentially achieve the same aims without warming the planet.
So if someone, an individual, has an air conditioner in their window, everyone has a refrigerator in their kitchen, are we all leaking this stuff?
Well, to some extent, you are potentially. And what's actually very interesting is that there are ways that you can look. And in fact, I had to do this recently when I bought a new refrigerator, having covered this issue for some time. Right. There are ways you can check and see what is the refrigerant that is in the appliance that you're purchasing and figure out whether it's an HFC or not. And there are plenty of alternatives, but you do need to do your homework to make sure that if you're making, one of these big purchases, you want to be diligent about it.
What are the alternatives? I'm curious about that.
They're a suite of things. There are some natural refrigerants. Ironically, actually, even using CO2 is less polluting. And there's a way that, for example, major supermarket chains are exploring that. There are things called HFOs, which again don't have the double bond and are also have a lower climate impact. So basically, there are these substitutes, and it's, as you mentioned, it's one of the reasons why this climate policy has enjoyed so much support, because it's actually something that industry here in the United States stands to gain jobs by switching over, and Republicans have embraced this idea. So as a result, it's really one of kind of the easiest things the U.S. can do to tackle climate change.
Now, my understanding that the HFCs, which is what we're talking about, were a substitute, and this is where we get into a lot of letters here, but there was a substitute for CFCs, which were, you know, blowing a hole in the ozone, correct?
Well, actually, they were, yeah, so basically, originally, yes, they were the substitute for that group of chemicals, but then the substitute that was created, didn't have the same impact on the climate, didn't have the same impact on the ozone layer, which people were concerned about, but still, like its predecessors, still had this warming component. So yes, it was trying to solve one problem, but it continued to create another
problem. So people use air conditioners, they use refrigerators. So by trying to cool the environment, we're actually heating the environment.
Yeah, it's pretty ironic. And again, part of one of the reasons why there's a real drive to try to phase out these chemicals is particularly if you look at, you know, many countries overseas, whether you're talking about India, or other developing countries, first of all, the planet's getting hotter, so there's an increased demand for air conditioning and refrigeration. And of course, you have folks who have more resources who might be buying these appliances or have more money to spend on these products. And so part of the drive right now is to try to develop and deploy substitutes. So as the world warms and as there's an increased demand for cooling, that we're not exacerbating the problem.
Right, that we're not warming the planet by trying to cool the planet. You did a really fascinating story a couple of months ago, actually back in February, looking at grocery store freezers, finding that there was just a lot of these HFCs that were being emitted. Help us understand what you found and what that tells us.
Sure. I mean, the Environmental Investigation Agency, which is actually a nonprofit that goes undercover and does these investigations, took equipment. It frankly almost looked like Ghostbusters. And they went in to, a number of grocery stores. This happened to be in the Washington area, the D.C. area. And they found that more than half the supermarkets surveyed with these leak detectors and infrared cameras were leaking HFCs. And of course, again, these are invisible. And also, I want to point out, these supermarkets, they actually have an incentive, and many of them are trying to curb leaks. But it's hard, it takes effort and money, and sometimes they don't even know how they're contributing to this pollution.
And is it because it costs them money? If you're leaking, that's you're leaking refrigerants, right?
Absolutely. So exactly, like you're losing that refrigerant charge, which ultimately you're going to have to replace, which is frankly why, on a broad basis, we do know how much is leaking, because they have to, the refrigerant escapes into the atmosphere. That means it's warming it. And then they have to buy new refrigerant. So they do have an incentive. But, sometimes it involves, really expensive repairs or substituting, totally new equipment. And so that, supermarkets run on tight margins. And so that's one of the reasons why this has been difficult to tackle in the past.
I mean, it is interesting that there seems that there's a lot of buy-in from people that normally are at loggerheads over a lot of these issues. What about issues, though, of enforcement or even the illegal production of HFCs? How serious a problem is that?
That's a great point. It's an extremely serious problem. And we've seen this, for example, in Europe, which is ahead of us on this issue in terms of they've adopted these restrictions before the United States. And they've already, ratified the international agreement. And so what's happened there is that they, again, have pursued pretty aggressive reductions of these chemicals. But there, as a result, and it's not entirely surprising that the illegal trade of HFCs spiked as they were ratcheting down the legal sale of these chemicals. And so one of the really interesting things is, because that problem was so visible, exposed actually by the same group, EIA and others, the Biden administration has implemented a number of measures in the new rule that just came out last week, where they're going to be tracking, you know, tracking the sale. They've got added enforcement. They're really going to try to see if they can avoid the illegal smuggling that we've seen in Europe.
You mentioned alternatives to HFC. Are these more readily available than they have been, or is this being fast-tracked so that obviously people need refrigerators, so but you need some kind of refrigerant to keep it chilly?
Right. So, I mean, they do exist. And I think what you're seeing, you know, there are plants that have opened up, you know, in recent years or switched over to this kind of production. We've seen that in whether it's in Louisiana or elsewhere, which is one of the reasons why there's a Republican Louisiana senator who helped co-author this legislation. So, you know, it is happening. But of course, it needs to be on a broader scale because all of the, you know, equipment has been in place to produce the old ones. But some of the biggest, you know, companies in the United States who are chemical manufacturers see a real incentive to produce these products, both for the U.S., but again, for all these other countries who are also restricting the use of these chemicals.
Interestingly, I mean, Biden has reversed a number of Trump-era policies, whether it was revoking the Keystone XL pipeline or rejoining the Paris Accord or reversing or undoing some federal rules. Is the significance of this, which is this is actual regulation going forward?
Yes, it is. It is more significant. I mean, we have an environmental regulatory tracker. We look at all the different things that that the president has done. And when you have a rule, particularly a rule that's finalized, this was final. You know, there's little sign that this is going to be challenged in court, unlike so many other policies. That it drives the market. And once that's locked in, that's kind of the way of life.
Well, and looking ahead, are there other issues where we're going to find similar consensus dealing with the environment?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, really. Go ahead, Juliet.
When I look ahead, here's what I would say. There are plenty of contentious issues, but actually, you know, if you look at things like the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which we expect to be finalized at some point this year, you do find areas of consensus, whether it's promoting the transition to electric vehicles. That's another example of where you have, you know, an agreement with industry and environmentalists. There are certainly, you know, for example, support for renewable energy. Often there's it's easier for, again, politicians across the country who have manufacturing in this area to get behind, say, the carrot of supporting wind and solar as opposed to the stick of making oil and gas and coal more expensive.
And we're almost out of time here, but do you think extreme weather, which we have all been experiencing, that has kind of focused the country?
What's very interesting is it doesn't seem to have shifted, for example, votes on Capitol Hill. But on the flip side, it looks like it really has raised the awareness among voters, average Americans, and that might translate into political change down the road.
Well, we have to leave it there. Juliet Alperin, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure, Marnie.
You're very welcome. And she's Deputy Climate and Environment Editor for The Washington Post. Coming up, how nature, we're talking plants and animals, are responding to the warming planet in innovative and surprising ways. We've got Tor Hansen waiting to join us after this very short break. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. It is harder and harder to find someone who doubts the existence of climate change after so much extreme weather and the measurable warming of the planet. Now the debate is focused on the most effective things to do to reduce harmful emissions before it's too late. So while we humans are trying to figure this out, nature is already responding. Our guest, conservation biologist Tor Hansen, writes in his new book, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, about the surprising ways that plants and animals are reacting to climate change. Some are moving, some are adapting, and some are going extinct. And all lizards in the Caribbean, for instance, have developed larger toe pads to better grip trees so they can survive more ferocious hurricanes. Tor Hansen writes, if bush crickets, bumblebees, and butterflies can learn to modify their behaviors, then it stands to reason that we can too. Tor Hansen joins us by Skype, and it's nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. And let me just make sure our listeners can join us, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Tor, in the author's note to this book, you say, this: yes, it's about climate change, but it is not a crisis book. Are you worried that too much of the discussions, even the writings about climate change, are too crisis oriented?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it is a crisis and it's deserving of that approach, but I also believe that it deserves our curiosity. This is such a widespread and overarching problem. It's touching all aspects of not just biology, but as your previous guest was pointing out, all sorts of our technologies and our politics are involved in this. And we need to be thinking about it from a lot of different angles. And one of the angles that I felt was really missing was the biological angle, not just the poor polar bear stranded on a shrinking iceberg, right, which has sort of been our stand-in image, but what else is happening in nature? What can we see and measure in the world all around us?
Well, you remind us that nothing is static on Earth, and that's how evolution happens. That's how adaptation happens. But it does feel as if things are speeded up and obviously heated up because things are speeded up. Is that true?
Yes. Change is constant. Change is constant, but what has changed is the pace of it. By warming the planet so dramatically, we are just putting, you know, literally putting fire underneath the frying pan of all of these changes, and we're seeing it play out very rapidly around us.
Well, there are no, I guess, climate deniers when it comes to nature, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting things. I mean, you think about how we've been arguing and debating about climate change for decades now, and yet you look out into nature and the plants and animals have just been getting on with dealing with it. And so I think there's a lesson there for us in terms of the practicality of coping with what's going on. Plants and animals are doing it every day.
And we're talking about moving. We're talking about, obviously, adaptation. We are, though, talking about polar bears and, you know, threatened species that could go extinct, correct?
Yes. I mean, that's something to keep in mind. And when we talk about the responses we see in nature and some of the resilience that we're able to measure, it's always, you know, couched within this greater acknowledgement that this is a crisis for plants and animals, too. And there are creatures that are going extinct. In fact, the little bramble key Malomi is a little mouse-like creature in Australia. It was recently the first mammal species confirmed to have gone extinct due to climate change when rising sea levels flooded all of its known habitat there in Australia. So it is a crisis for plants and animals too, but we can learn a lot from their responses.
Well, let me pick something closer to home. This would be Walden Pond in Massachusetts. You write that the temperatures have risen 4.3 degrees in the last 160 years. I'm assuming that's Fahrenheit. That's a lot of warming for a pond. Tell us what's happening there and how the ecosystem, the system has responded.
Well, Walden Pond has become really an important site for studying climate change biology. And the reason why, well, one is, as you mentioned, the warming in the air there is dramatic, in part due to global changes, in part due to local changes as well, with the, you know, increased urbanization and suburban development in that area. You've seen a lot of warming. But the key factor dates right back to good old Henry David Thoreau, in that not only was he out there, you know, in the woods thinking about all sorts of our aspects of our relationships to nature and philosophy and so forth. But he was also a great observer of the plants and animals around his little cabin, and he kept detailed notes that if you look at pages of the note, they look like a 19th century spreadsheet. He Wow. was a scientist in the making, and he took notes on when the first birds arrived of various species, and he took notes on when the leaves came out on the shrubs and when the wildflowers bloom, and he wrote it down for several years. And all those notes were just locked away. No one published them. They were hidden. Scientists didn't know about them until 10 or so years ago when these things started to come to light. And that has now become the baseline for which we can compare changes in nature in that Walden Pond forest ecosystem. And that is a very rare thing because not many people were taking notes with such detail at that time. So by looking and comparing modern occurrences there with what Thoreau saw, we're able to see how that forest ecosystem is changing. Wildflowers blooming weeks earlier than they used to. He used to write of the lovely, what he called the yellow smell of willows in the early spring. Huh. Well, now that's 3-4 weeks earlier happening than it used to when he was there. So if he came back to Walden today, I think he would be surprised by, you know, the gift shop and the parking lot that take people in to visit it. But I think what he would be more surprised at would be all the changes he could see as a naturalist walking through that forest today.
Is that a sign of resilience? Or have there been winners and losers at Walden Pond, though?
Yeah, what a great question. I mean, so it is in that you look toward how plants and animals are able to respond. And if they can change and adapt to new conditions and survive, then that's a good thing. That's resilience in action. So responding to those warmer temperatures in springtime, if you can, by advancing your flowering date, if that works for you, that's a good response. And what a fellow named Richard Premack, who's at Boston University and has been studying this now for years, what he and his team have discovered that it is those flexible species that have an advantage now. The ones that aren't able to change their flowering date, that don't have that what biologists call plasticity, the flexibility, the ability to bend their habits to meet new conditions, those are the ones that tend to suffer. If you can imagine in a forest, you are a wildflower sitting next to your neighbor. And in the springtime, your neighbor gets started 2 weeks earlier than you do. That gives them potentially a tremendous advantage in that they've got 2 weeks of growth as a head start. They're ahead of you in competing for resources in that little patch of ground. And you see that going on and playing out at Walden. It's those flexible species that have the advantage over the conservative ones that are sticking to the old ways.
Oh, such a fascinating thing to think about. That's Tor Hansen, our guest on Radio Times today. He's a conservation biologist. He's got a new book we're talking about. It's titled Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, subtitled The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. Any questions, comments at 1-888-477-9499. I just did a sentence about the Anole lizards in my introduction to you, Tor, about these lizards that have developed these larger toe pads. They've got shorter back legs, and it's in response, apparently, to the fact that down in the Caribbean, there are more powerful hurricanes. In order to hang on to a tree, you've got to evolve and develop, appendages that can hold you onto that tree. Is that the kind of plasticity you're talking about?
Well, what a marvelous question. And this actually gets at something that may be a little bit far out in the weeds, so to speak, but that biologists love to parse. And that is the difference between what we call plasticity, which is the baked-in response that we can have to changing conditions that's already within our genetic makeup, and what we term then the difference between that and evolution, where you have new characteristics developing within a population. population and being passed down to the next generation. And what's so marvelous about that lizard story is that it is a sign of measurable evolution in action. Yeah. This story comes to us from a fellow named Colin Donahue, who's a herpetologist, who went down to the Caribbean, to the Turks and Caicos, to study this little lizard, because there was a project going on to remove non-native rats from the islands where the lizard lived. And the rats were eating the lizards. So the idea was you measure all the lizards, take the rats away, and then see how the lizards rebound over time. Well, he did all the measurements, and then 2 weeks later, two Category 4 hurricanes swept over those islands and devastated the place. And it was, of course, horrible for the people there, horrible for the forest and the creatures. And the rat project was put on indefinite hold. But what he realized was that it was a rare opportunity to potentially measure natural selection in action. So he patched together some funding, went right back, and in a sort of scientific deja vu, repeated the exact experiment, the exact measurements he had done 6 weeks earlier, he and his team. And what they saw then was, as you described, the topaz of the lizards, the survivors, were measurably larger, and they also had stronger front legs. And the odd thing was, he measured they had smaller back legs, and he couldn't figure that out. He couldn't figure it out until he replicated a hurricane, honestly, in the hotel room where they were all staying. They had a leaf blower set up, and they had lizards on sticks so they could see how the lizards reacted to wind. And, of course, they hunkered down on the lee side of the stick and then held on tight. And as the winds increased, their back legs would slip free, and they looked like a sail flapping in the wind, holding on tight with those front toe pads and front legs. And so it was those lizards that had those traits, strong legs, big toe pads, and short back legs for less drag in the wind, that survived these hurricane force winds. And by going back then in subsequent years, they could see how that was being passed down to future generations, and you had actual evolution, natural selection going on, survival of the fittest, if you will, for these traits in that lizard population.
So many questions, but one would be, do we know how quickly those lizards evolved to be able to hang on to trees so effectively?
Isn't that marvelous? I mean, we think of evolution as something playing out over centuries or even thousands of years, which of course it does. But if you're in the right place at the right time, you can see steps in that process, in Colin's case, play out in a single field season. Wow. By being there for such a dramatic event, that measurable change in the traits in that population, it can take place very quickly. But what was really interesting too for his project is he wanted to know, is this really what he would term, and a biologist would term, directional? Is it sustained pressure changing the lizard population in one direction? Or is this what we might call a little wobble? Is it going to change a little bit because of that hurricane, but then it doesn't really matter in the long term, and the traits change back again? And we see that in nature too, where, you know, traits will wobble around some sort of average condition over time. So Colin took the next step then by looking at the same kinds of lizards over the entire Caribbean and determining that in places where hurricanes are more frequent, the lizards do indeed show these traits. Wow. Those populations have the larger toe pads and the strong front legs. So we can see that in the narrow view for a single season, you can see it happen. And then if you take a broad view and look at longer evolutionary history, those traits persist. It is directional selection in response to hurricanes.
Evolution in action. Here's a question from Melanie saying, can your guest, that would be you, Dora Hansen, discuss invasive species? She says, I'm thinking of non-native plants, lanternflies, stink bugs, etc.
Sure. So this is another challenge that we face, and something I think that's worth pointing out is when we talk about what climate change does in the environment that's difficult for plants and animals, this rapid change, there are a number of things that occur. You know, the timing of events, as we talked about from Walden Pond, changes. That's something. You have these extreme weather events that are a challenge, like the lizards in the Caribbean. That's something. But all of that is playing out against the backdrop in the modern era of these additional challenges that we've set up for them in their environment. And that is the loss of habitat by the expansion of our populations, various sorts of pollution that impact the natural world. And another one that you hit upon is the challenge of invasive species, which we've been dealing with, you know, regardless of climate change. We have moved so many species around that we have these things like lanternflies and other invasives that are out of the context of where they evolved, and that in some cases can allow them to spread rapidly and outcompete native species. So we see that already with what we've done. We see the challenge then complicated and increased in some cases because of climate change, in that these invasive species, in some cases, they're very flexible. That's one of the reasons they have done well in their new environment where we've moved them. They tend to be flexible, generalist, plastic, if you will. They can adapt quickly. And so now we're setting up additional challenges for the native species in their environment. And in some cases, that's giving those invasives an increase in an advantage they already enjoyed.
And we're almost up on a break here, but just picking up on that. So is it did we do that? Or is it that invasive species looking for that environment in order to thrive have moved themselves into warmer climates and then taking over forests, for instance?
Yeah, so in terms of the invasives, it's something we've done and that we have been the ones to move them around. And then if you look at it from how plants and animals are moving in response to climate change alone, that is another, you know, thing fundamentally that we have done now to nature, where we are also scrambling the pot, if you will, and moving, you know, things are moving between, oh, they estimate between a quarter and as much as 85% of the species on the planet are adjusting their home ranges in terms of dealing with climate change, looking for the conditions they're used to in terms of temperature and other climatic characteristics in the environment. So we're moving things around and creating these what we call novel ecosystems with a bunch of species thrown together that haven't necessarily interacted before, and that is creating some level of chaos in a lot of natural communities. So it's invasive species that we have moved physically in the past, compounded by these additional climate change challenges, moving more species in response to those changing conditions.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation with Tor Hansen. He's a conservation biologist. He's written several books, including Feathers, The Triumph of Seeds, Buzz, and he's got a new one. It's called Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. And I will talk about plastic squid after this very short break. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Why we humans debate what to do about climate change, nature is already responding. I'm talking with Tor Hansen about how plants and animals are reacting to this warming planet, some adapting, some moving, some going extinct. And again, Tor Hansen's new book is Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. Well, let's talk about plastic squid. And you mentioned this earlier about the role that plasticity plays, I guess, in survival, the idea of flexibility, being able to respond to a changing environment. Help us understand what these plastic squid were doing in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, this is a marvelous story because everyone thought that the squid were gone. We're talking about Humboldt squid, which support a large squid fishery, well, in a number of places. They have a big range, but in the Gulf of California, people have been catching these squid on hooks out there for decades. And then after a series of marine heat waves, climate driven, the squid were gone. Or so everyone thought, until they really went out and did surveys and learned that, in fact, the squid were still there and more numerous than ever. But when the waters warmed, the squids responded to that heat stress by totally transforming their lifestyle. They started eating different foods. They matured twice as quickly and bred in only 6 months, at 6 months of age. They lived half as long. And under these constraints, their bodies, which under normal conditions would be 5-6 feet long, huge squid in some cases, reached only a fraction of that size. So they were too small to even bite the hooks that people were using to try to catch them. And the few that people could hook, they would dismiss as juveniles or even another species, and they would throw them back and assume that the squid had moved on to cooler waters somewhere else. But in fact, the squid were still there. They responded with the natural adaptability that was built into their makeup already. They could totally change not just what they did, but actually how they looked in response to that difference.
So that is plasticity. That is flexibility in response to a changing environment.
It is. And Humboldt squid, they're like the Olympians of plasticity. I mean, the fact they can look so different. And I think the Olympics are a good analogy for us all to get our heads around that idea, in that when we look at the Paralympics athletes and the Olympic athletes who recently descended upon Tokyo for those games, many of them did so literally, because elite athletes very often train at high elevation. And they do that to take care of advantage of plasticity that exists within us, within people. If you go up into the mountains where the air is less dense, every breath you take contains fewer molecules of oxygen, which is why people often will be out of breath when they're first up in an alpine environment. But if you stay there and if you train there as an athlete, your body adjusts. It is plastic in how it deals with oxygen. It will produce more red blood cells and alter blood flow and breathing patterns to compensate for that air that is less dense. And so for athletes, you train in that environment, then you come down to a place like Tokyo at sea level to compete, and your body is moving more oxygen around, and you get a small boost from that, which is taking advantage of our plasticity. You don't have to evolve that reaction. It's already there. That potential is waiting there in your body. And that's just what an example of what those plastic squid were doing. The potential to be small and to live differently was there, and the warm water triggered it.
Well, in using nature as a kind of guide, can we say that the more specialized a plant or animal is, the more at risk they are for either extinction or just to struggle to survive because they're so specialized to a certain environment, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the general themes that we take away from looking broadly at climate change biology. The creatures and plants that are generalists, they get along in all sorts of conditions, like the dandelions that grow in your driveway.
Dandelions, yeah, no, I love that flower, yeah.
We don't have to worry about dandelions. They're going to be fine. I mean, they grow differently, and they grow in all conditions, and they bloom at any time of year. They're very flexible. But if you then look at a specialist, a wildflower, for example, that relies upon only one bee as its pollinator, that sort of tight co-evolved relationship, that makes species more vulnerable to rapid change. Because if they don't, both species in the partnership don't react in exactly the same way at the same time, they can be pulled apart. And they're more at risk then of suffering and ultimately even of extinction.
You're a conservation biologist, then you were talking about humans and our ability to be flexible, to go, breathe thin air in order to be able to compete. So are we both a sort of mix of highly specialized but also generalized?
Sure, we have specialist capabilities too, but I think really if you look at Homo sapiens, one of the superpowers has to be plasticity, the ability to live in all sorts of In different environments. We are on every continent on the planet. We live at all, you know, altitudes. We use our technology in some way, our capacity to invent and innovate, to expand our plasticity and allow us to dominate really every continent, yeah. All habitats.
But are you also saying that because we have these abilities, these skills, that we can survive climate change, or what?
Oh, great question. And I, you know, as a biologist, I would look at our species and say that is a flexible, adaptable species.
Okay, well, that's good.
They're likely to survive, but what's at risk? What's really at risk would be the way of life that we have established, and by that I mean the standard of living that we either enjoy or aspire to on this planet, in terms of the comforts that we enjoy and the stability of our our systems that we live within. That is more at risk rather than Homo sapiens as a species, because we are quite adaptable.
Are we an invasive species?
Well, that depends upon who asks. Yes, I'm sure there are other species on the planet that think, well, where did this big upright bipedal ape come from that's disturbing everything? That's an invasive species. Can't we get some weed killer for that in some fashion? So I think that is a matter of perspective.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, talking with conservation biologist Tor Hansen. He's got a new book. It's called Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. We've talked a lot about climate change on this show over the last couple of decades. From a more human perspective, this obviously is a different perspective on something that's happening to all of us. All around us, actually. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You tell a really interesting story about bears, you know, switching from a diet largely of salmon to elderberries. I happen to have a fondness for bears. What's this story about? What does it tell us?
So one of the most overarching and common themes that I encountered in researching this book, talking to scientists around the world, is how they would go out into the field expecting to study one thing and come back with a totally different data set because the conditions on the ground were so different, they ended up studying something else. And this story comes to us from a fellow named Will Deasy, who went to Kodiak Island in Alaska to study the brown bears. He has a fondness for them, just like you, Marty, and that was what he was going to do his research on. And he was interested in how the bears move from watershed to watershed, depending upon the timing of the salmon runs, how they manage their time to always be at the peak salmon run for all these various different streams where the salmon come up. And the Kodiak bears are famous for being particularly large, and everyone always assumed this had to do in part with the abundance of salmon in that environment. You know, it's just axiomatic that bears love salmon. So he had this thing all set up. He was out there studying his bears, counting fish, and then right in the middle of peak salmon season, all the bears just left. They disappeared. They left the streams and disappeared. And he said it was lucky they had some of them radio collared, because then they were able to follow them and see what was going on. And what he realized was that they had all gone up into the hills for berry season. And not just any berry, but red elderberries, which are what he described as a weird berry. Rather than being sort of sweet and full of sugars and starches, elderberries have starches, but they also have a lot of protein. Huh. And so it was a perfect bear food, and something that bears had been eating later in the season, sort of post-salmon. They would switch over to elderberries and other berries in that environment. But in response to climate change, the elderberries in particular have begun blooming and then fruiting earlier and earlier and earlier in the season, so that now the elderberry season is right at peak salmon season. So if you give these bears a chance, a choice really, if they are forced to choose between salmon and elderberries, they go for the elderberries. Because while we know that salmon are decent food for bears and that bears eat a lot of salmon, the salmon are so rich in protein that they're actually not as nutritious as something like an elderberry, which offers this balance of carbohydrates and protein all in one package. So, you know, Will's perspective was, hey, this is actually a pretty good move for the bears. You're seeing them respond to climate change just as they should, which is going for this this food that is really a perfect bear food, even better for them than the salmon. They'll take a break, they'll get the elderberries, they'll come back to the stream and finish their season on salmon, and they'll probably be all the better for it, maybe even larger than they were to begin with on Kodiak.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you about whether that would change the shape, the size of these bears.
Yes, it's likely to, in that... Well, one way to think about the salmon diet is to think of some of these high-protein diets that people will use to lose weight, because the body gets calories out of the proteins and the fats, but it doesn't put on fat in the same way that we do when we eat a lot of carbs, you know, a big bunch of pasta and these other high carbohydrate foods, sugars, refined sugars, and so forth. Add weight to our bodies faster than a strictly meat diet, like the Atkins diet or the South Beach diet, all these high protein diets. Well, bears were suffering in a sense the same thing. If they're just eating salmon, they're getting a lot of calories, but they're not able to put on as much fat. And bears need the fat because they need fat to hibernate. So bears have always put on a lot of pounds in the fall when they've been eating berries. But now they've had to adjust that schedule, at least for the red elderberries, to get that key food in the summertime because it's now fruiting so early.
So what are the message from our animal friends, the animal kingdom, to us then about how to adapt, how to respond to climate change?
I think if we look out at nature, we see plants and animals doing everything they can. And I like that phrase because it is practical. You know, in some cases, it will be enough for them to survive. In some cases, their populations will suffer, or they'll have to change where they live and so on. But they're, you know, at an individual species level, they're doing whatever they can to cope with this. And I like that lesson because we can use that in our own lives. We can't do it is a big problem, and individual action can't solve climate change, but it can help to change the behaviors that are bringing it about. And that is how we use energy, our relationship to energy, how we choose to drive and to travel, and how we choose to shop and how we choose to eat. All of those things influence this larger picture. And some naysayers will tell you that it's such a big problem that individual action is inconsequential. But that's precisely wrong, in that what we're talking about is a cultural shift. So individual action is actually more important because it's the sum of our individual actions that change a culture. And I would reference a comment by your earlier guest who pointed out that right now, after this spate of extreme weather we have seen over the past several months, you know, she said the policymakers in Washington haven't yet changed their viewpoints, but many voters have changed their viewpoints, and that will eventually change the policy. That's what we're talking about when we talk about doing what we can for climate change, in that when we change as voters, as individuals, as consumers, we change the culture. And I think that's now starting to take place.
And would the number one thing be to get off fossil fuels? Fossils, of course, from plants and animals, right?
Yeah, well, as your guest earlier said, there are other considerations like air conditioning chemicals and all sorts of things. But one of the things we can do quickest and we must do is to, reduce our use of fossil fuels and switch over to renewables. And it is something we can, approach immediately because the technology is there. It's a matter of willpower. So I think when you start to make that shift in mass, and I think we're starting to see it happen more and more, you'll see some real results. And I think when people start thinking about energy in that way, it changes things at the policy level as well.
Well, fingers crossed that happens. Tor Hanson, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for all the great questions, and really appreciate being on again.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was Tor Hanson. He is a conservation biologist, as I mentioned. Joined us by Skype. He's written several books, including Feathers, The Triumph of Seeds, Buzz, and his new one is called Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. For more information about the show, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.